also related to a talk that Mike Smith is doing on Thursday about DStreamer in general, and so he's going to tell us a bit about what he's going to talk about then. Last we're going to hear from Jonathan Wojta about Linux FireWire interfaces. Sorry, I don't have my phone. Okay, so here we go.
All right. Hello, everyone. So today I'm going to talk about adventures in consumer electronics with GStreamer. My name is Mikko Leppänen. My email address is there. Yes, it's at nokia.com. I work as a project leader in Nokia. It's a Finnish company, and I'm stationed there. I work for Maimo.org, which is our community for the internet tablets. In special, I'm working in the multimedia team, multimedia framework to be exact, and my latest project was called N810, which is this thing. This talk is going to be on the slides and no hands-on demos or anything because the facilities are not really good and you can't see all the tiny pixels from there. I think about everyone here already has one, or if you do, just raise your hand.
Do we email you for free ones?
Yes, so quite a few. Right, let's do so that questions at the end, and if you want to see the device, there are a few around, mine is at least available. And just, close the Gmail account. You see. Okay, so I'm going to talk about GStreamer in the sense that, I put there why we love GStreamer. So from the, architecture point of view, why it's nice for us. Then I'm going to talk about the users. That would be you, mostly. And about projecting. Lovely little thing, which I just kind of squeezed in here because that's what I do a lot. If you're interested or not, I don't know. Okay, first, a question. Do you want to hear talk about GStreamer in consumer electronics or talk about consumer electronics with GStreamer? So what do you want to be the focus? Consumer electronics? GStreamer? GStreamer. Okay, good. That's then clear. All right, so the rest of the people. Yeah, GStreamer. Since that's the main focus now, to set the stand, so this is, there is no tutorials, very noble, actually no code and so on, so for that, see gstreamer.freedesktop.org. But why GStreamer is nice? It's popular, which is nice. Then people actually know what you're talking about when you say GStreamer. It's scalable. Scalable means that you can run it on your PC, and you can run it on your N810. This is so very lovely. And the all the details may not be the completely the same. But for that, it's pluggable, which means that we can have a hardware-optimized video codec running on the N810 and a default plugin running on PC. But the rest of the framework can be the same. Most of the issues in doing a media framework nowadays, or anyway somewhere else in the codex, which is due to the nice thing that codex are usually based on specifications and standards, which means that somebody has actually written down what the piece of code should do, and as an end result, codex usually do what they are supposed to do. It's the fluff around them that may or may not work. I think there are a few talks also in this conference about why seeking OGs is difficult. So that kind of doing the codec is easy. The rest is not so nice. GStreamer is LGPL, which is very nice. It means that it's open source, which I'll talk more about. But then also, it means that together with the fact that it's a pluggable, you can have proprietary plugins, which in the current day and age is still considered important by the users. Whether that here equals with you, I'm not so sure. But the feedback I get daily is quite clear that proprietary plugins are nice. So it's nice that we can still cooperate with everyone else on the areas where it's possible. GStreamer is easy to learn since the APIs are somewhat well-defined and you can pick your own sandbox and play around there, kind of take a single plugin or a single feature and you can just muck around with that and learn that bit of code and move on. I guess this talk could also be kind of titled why good APIs or modular architectures are nice, but when this time in a context of GStreamer. It's also easy to understand. You can also kind of draw nice graphs of how the various plugins connect to each other. That's easy to explain to everyone. See, here we have the demuxer and then the audio and video decoder and so on and so on. Then there is a very clear high-level picture available. Easy to specify. This, in any reasonably sized project as ours, you will end up having teams that are somewhat disconnected, and you want to agree beforehand that you guys do this thing, we do something else. And trust me that it's a lot easier to say that, please, can you find out a good, let's say, MPEG-4 container format demuxer as a GStreamer plugin than to start going through write a software that takes an input from any arbitrary input thingy, something, and produces, it gets messy. So having a solid framework with all of this, all of the basics specified, it shortens the communication a lot when doing basically the software requirements or whatever you want to call them. That also means that it's easy to test. Every kind of there is a very minimal set of what every GStreamer plugin should do, but it's still surprisingly kind of once that the basic every GStreamer plugin should do that, if the plugin passes those, it actually is quite close to working already. Then there is GST Inspect, a nice online tool which tells you everything that you need to know about a plugin. A lot better than any documentation ever, since it's always up to date and you always know which parameters you need to set on your encoder to get a decent quality video stream going from the camera. Okay. That's the good part about bugability. Assumptions. Everybody has assumptions. Assumptions are good. You just need to know which assumptions you're going to make. In this particular case, I'll talk about the fact that you could assume that you need to support this particular specification. I believe it's also known as MP3 in some circles. So you could just assume that, yes, we are doing an MP3 player. Many people are doing MP3 players quite successfully. And that's an okay assumption. We did that, but then somebody came with a kind of changed a few numbers there. We need to support this also, and that also. And then there is AAC, and then there is AAC high efficiency, then there is AAC plus, and then there is enhanced AAC plus, and so on. So that gets a little bit challenging. So yeah, let's not assume that we do only MP3. For that we have Playbin. Playbin is just a single module in the GStreamer family, but it does something nice called auto-plugin. So it basically tries to identify the type of file you give it as input, figures out a way to read that file, next figures out how to perhaps get it out of the container it may be in, and so on, all dynamically based on the libraries you happen to have on your device. And that is so very nice. It makes it possible to add Ogvorbi support to your internet tablet just by adding, but I know it, so it's an assumption I'm aware of. By adding the necessary decoder plugin and adding a file type mapping. And at the same time, you can also just replace the MP3 decoder plugin with a newer one, and the next time you try to play something, the new version will be used, and it's all very dynamic and nice. But you can still do assumption. Playbin does an assumption that you end up with a raw audio file, a raw PCM audio, and place it to the default audio sync or something like that. Whereas, well, we have GST DSP MP3 sync module, which basically is an audio output device thing which plays back MP3s. So, since we knew this assumption, we could go back to Playbin and modify it a little bit here and there and a few other places also. That is very nice. So, assumptions. So as long as you know which assumptions you have made, it's good. Then you know which things you need to change, and then you know when the assumptions are being broken by external changes. GST launch, another command line tool for GStreamer. With that, you can do stuff like this. Trust me, this is the longest slide on the presentation. So this is from a live or in production use shell script that is used to measure what is our frames per second performance on any format. This is from the part where we play 3GP files with AAC audio IC. And this is very, very useful since as you can see, all of the key parameters of the pipeline are easily modifiable. We can figure out whether it's the quality of service or the AV sync or perhaps the buffering that is giving us trouble. And we can also replace the decoder with any alternative decoder if you happen to have them. And that means that it's testable since there is a command line access to it, so it's quite easy to even automate things so that you can test, let's say, 20,000 random web clips every night and see whether your software is working today or not. It's fixable.
Well, it has no bugs.
yeah, exactly. It just has assumptions which we are breaking, yes. It's a completely different thing. so this is, I should have used hackable. Although, of course, all our modifications are done in extremely clean manner. And yes, it's very magical. It just works in so many surprising ways. Okay, I hope you now understood that it's perfect. Ours is still a little bit patched due to some assumptions. So officially, if you look at the documentation, the software here is running GStreamer 0.10.13 of the core and the base plugins, I think. When the software was ready, 0.10.14 was already available. And if you would do a kind of overall diff, you would figure out that the software there is actually quite close to 0.10.15, which was the latest SVN at the time. Which I guess is normal in software development. This situation perhaps wasn't the same when we started, but nowadays I'm very happy and proud of the fact that our problems are the same problems that the upstream GStreamer has. We are not anymore fighting with the kind of stupid hacks that are our own problems, and kind of we deserve to suffer for those. So in the development of N810, several bugs were fixed by importing the latest SVN to the correct place, and the problems just disappeared. That might also be because we sent a few patches in for the previous round, and that of course applies to all the other patches we do. They are being fed upstream because then we don't need to port them, hopefully. Yes, that was the silver lining. We don't use much codecs as such from GStreamer, but as discussed earlier, codecs are easy. You can just kind of take the number. See, this is the ISO specification number, and here you have the GStreamer interface. Go run, make it. That's easy. Yeah. Okay, what good stuff I had about. Yeah. That's what I had about GStreamer. Then about users. Let's say this is just a random figure. It would be nice to have 10 million users. We know that we have one software release, one device, and we definitely want to have zero configuration options. So this is not an easy equation to solve, but we get a fair amount of feedback on the products, and I go through them. The only relevant feedback, kind of, there's only one feedback that I've received about a few thousand times. That
is.
Yes, quite close. It kind of, I've made a general one so that I can call it one problem. Okay, it's video here, but bad codec support or whatever you want to have it. That's what is relevant for the multimedia framework. Basically what I want to say here is that users want tools. We try to make tools in some sense. At least I've kind of heard the stuff say that, tools do stuff, like cats. It concatenates files, as everybody here knew. Or cut, it does something else, but it's a little bit more complex piece of software, but it does what it does in a reasonably well-defined way. And GCC does what it does. It compiles files. As you might have noticed, GCC is not anymore that simple in implementation. And this is our problem also, because our tool is not a codec. It's not MP3 decoder. A tool is not a framework, but a tool is the it's possible to make a tool with a combination of a nice framework and a few codecs. The way I would define a tool in the sense as it applies the multimedia framework on 810 is that it plays multimedia files. That's unfortunately the specification that I'm stuck with. It doesn't have a slot for the shiny silver disks, luckily, because then we would need to play those also for to be able to call it as a multimedia tool. So now it just needs to play all the files that you can kind of somehow electronically with magic, perhaps wirelessly transfer there. So, yeah, it would be nice to do excuses. I even had a few here. no excuses. And that also means that currently after Flash, which is not really kind of nobody seriously considers Flash videos to be multimedia, so. So after that, the next popular format is this thing called .wmv or whatever it's thing. So some technology from some company. So it ends up that it kind of once you have support for Windows Media, users are happier. The developers might not be, but such is life. That's what I had on users about background on projecting. So nowadays it's I already agreed that you cannot do software projects with deadlines. Start up with a fixed set of requirements and finish them a year from now. But I still would like to explain shortly why we perhaps try to do it, even though it's not commonly done. Of course, you need to have shiny features, so you need to do something. Traditionally, it's ready when it's ready, but consumer electronics means that it's an embedded device, or embedded in general. Embedded means that there is a combination of hardware and software that together bring out the magic. A few things about hardware which you might or might not know. Hardware is slow. By this, I mean that the schedules for the hardware people are terribly long, kind of. They want to know today if they do something in 2 years' time. And then kind of, then they do stupid stuff like say that in 2 years' time, kind of on this minute and hour, we'll be ready. So you better be ready at that time too. And then hardware is expensive, which means that when the hardware guys say that we are ready in kind of 2010, 2nd of February, 11 o'clock, Finnish or Eastern European standard time, you need to be ready at that time because the hardware cannot wait. It's, yeah, a lot of money has been spent on it, so it better have some software to run on it. So that's why kind of my grandpa always asks what am I going to do when I grow up. I never could really answer. Now it's much easier. I just need to know what I'm going to do in 1 year's time. Yeah. Okay. That's what I had on projecting. Questions? It does.
And you write coding for that, or you?
Yeah, okay, so N810 does support Windows Media 9 videos and Windows Media Audio 9 files. It does Windows Media streaming and yes, it's all still using GStreamer. And we can play the files from all the sources that are supported by GStreamer. And then the AV sync and so on is common code with everything else.
Is this all using the MIDI player that comes with it? There was some discussion quickly, as an version of the operating system of N810. There was some discussion of the A and B. I mean, potentially swallow it up and use this as the call client.
Okay, the question was about the default client versus UK MP, Urhokonttori's media player. They both use the same framework, so everything said here today applies to both in that sense. And what will be the UI in the future, I don't honestly know. Well, at least Urho is nowadays, I think, sitting in the hall somewhere next to me, so that's a good tip for everyone who wants to first write cool software for the tablets and then move to Helsinki. It's a lovely city. And well, that I think I can confirm. any comments about future products and respective dates? I'm sorry, no.
If he says anything, he'll be killed by the Nokia.
Yeah. So kind of, there are already a few people there, kind of unnecessary trigger happy. So. No, it's completely Linux-based, and most of it is open source, and you can find all of it in mimo.org. Okay, yes. I have experience with Helix, which is running here also, and then I have some experience with the Symbian multimedia framework. They all have the same goals, so everybody has so far understood that you need to separate the codecs, have a good codec abstraction, and everybody else has failed. So So Helix here is, I think it's a 1.5 megabyte binary chunk. You can check on your own device. So it's a single blob of software that does what it does if it feels like it. And I think there was a disclaimer somewhere, especially on the whiny users part that, no, this is. it's a really difficult kind of. GStreamer had a few iterations, and then also there is OpenMax, which is a similar codec abstraction layer being defined by Kronos, which is kind of, from my point of view, it's a direct copy of GStreamer. So to me, that tells that we are kind of finally getting it correct. And the kind of the inspiration for me for having this talk in the first place is that I'm really impressed with how kind of close we are now for having something that really works, having seen a few failures also. DRM and copyrights, have we looked at them? Yes. Comments? Currently, kind of, DRM comments, there is certainly kind of incentive for doing DRM in a product today. Doing DRM on a device where you have the root password is not easy, and that's actually kind of the way I would like to keep it. So. All right. Thank you.
So I'm Michael Smith, I'm one of the GStreamer hackers. I work for Fluendo in Spain, no longer actually working on GStreamer most of the time, but working on applications using it. I'm giving a talk on Thursday afternoon about GStreamer, not from the sort of the users, when I say user, I mean the developers that are trying to use the library in applications. But my talk on Thursday is going to be about actually writing applications with GStreamer, what the capabilities are, what the more advanced things that you can do with it that go beyond just writing a media player, which is what a lot of people have seen from GStreamer. So if you're interested, if you want to know more, if you want to go into a bit more technical detail, come along on Thursday afternoon, listen to me talk.
I'm just going to give a brief rundown on this thing called FIDO, or FIDO, or however you pronounce it. I've never really given it much thought until today, to be honest. I apologise for the brevity of the slides, because until about 4 hours ago I wasn't going to be doing this. But I thought that with some of the talk about some of the, you know, the LibSydney and stuff like that, and Jack and all that, that maybe it'd be a good idea just to touch base and let people know what's actually going on with this thing called FIDO, which basically exists to put or give Linux access to audio devices which run using FireWire. So FIDO is an acronym, Free FireWire Audio Driver something else. When they were naming it about 12 months ago, they thought that the O was good, so they put it on. But I don't actually think it stands for anything. So if anybody's got any useful ideas, then I'm sure we could take them on board. As I said on the slide, it's a framework to use external audio devices utilising FireWire to connect to the PC. So instead of using USB or a bus, they use FireWire to get the audio into the computer. At the moment, FIDO exists as a jack backend, so anything that can use jack can use the devices supported by FIDO. I'm not a primary author on this. Primary authors are Daniel and Peter. I contributed one of the backends to FIDO. Why do we do this? A lot of the professional multi-channel interfaces for audio are actually using FireWire as an interconnect now. Presumably because it is quite an easy thing to connect. It doesn't need its own dedicated PCI card as some of the earlier generation multi-channel interfaces did. The interfaces themselves are really cool for audio, and so we want to make those devices available to people who run Linux. And for me personally, it was like a surmountable challenge, because even if the manufacturers decide to dig their heels in and not support us, FireWire is slightly easier to probe than a PCI bus, and a lot cheaper than a bus analyzer. Just brief history of the project. FIDO started off in, I think it was 2004 or 5. It was called FreeBob back then, and that came about because it was originally devised to only talk to a certain number of devices, and technically they were devices using this thing called the DM1000, which is a hardware-based FireWire audio bridge chip made by a mob called BridgeCo, who incidentally Daniel works for. And that was kind of helpful because they provided him with a whole heap of development boards and other internal documentation that greatly helped getting it working on those boards. In 2006, the scope of the project expanded to include other audio FireWire devices, not just those based on the DM1000. And the main motivation there was because when I came along with this idea that I wanted to support this other device, it was probably quite rightly pointed out that really we only really want one uniform method of accessing these devices under Linux, instead of having, you know, a different API for every device in existence. It's much better to collect them all up into one structure, and that's what we basically did. We did release a FreeBob 1. I think it was maybe late 2006, early 2007. It only supported a certain number or a small selection of the of these DM1000 devices. FreeBob basically came from the name BBOB, which is the internal operating system used by the DM1000, so that's where that name came from. We renamed to FIDO in early 2007 because of the extended scope, and that also made numerous manufacturers happy, because they weren't happy about cooperating with a project that was basically promoting an opposition solution to the whole FireWire problem. And so with that name change, it sort of brought a few extra manufacturers on board. So I started with this in about early 2006. I bought myself a Motu Traveler interface, which is a 22-channel device. Knew it didn't work with Linux, but had a reasonable reasonable chance of working with it because of some sniffing that somebody else had done before I bought it. So I deduced the protocol needed to talk to this device, and there's really two aspects to it. One is to work out the format of the audio data that's streaming down the line, but the other, possibly more complex and more important aspect of it, is how to control the device, how to tell it to start sending audio, and how to tell it to stop, and how to tell it to do things like sample rate selection. It took a while. By the end of 2006, the Motu FreeBob backend was working. There were some caveats with it about how you could use it, what you could get away with while you were still doing it, but basically it worked. And I've used the final FreeBob snapshot before the rename to do quite a number of multi-channel recordings in the field on pretty much mission critical stuff, and it hasn't let me down. It's reasonably stable if you use it within the confines of, within the limitations of the system. Challenges, the biggest problem is that although we've got things like IEC 61883 and some of the trade association documentations, most vendors decide they're not good enough, and so they either at best use vendor extensions, which are allowed by those standards, or in the case of Motu, they throw the entire standard out and do their own. If they don't give you the protocol documentation, it's not all that easy to control these things, so you've got to reverse engineer it, basically. The other interesting thing with FireWire Audio is that the audio clock in the device, you have to be able to sync to that so the rest of your audio system can be synced to it. And the only way you can do that is by inferring that clock from the timestamps that are coming back by the receipt in the data that's coming back from the device. Syncing up to that is surprisingly difficult. Fado uses delay lock loops to achieve that. At the moment, we still have issues with stability because some devices, like the Motu, are extremely picky with their timing. The Bebop devices are a lot freer in what they will accept and still remain locked. The Motu, you don't have to deviate very far from ideal before it just kicks up its heels and dies and just gives you some really nasty sounds. We've got a lack of other challenges for a lack of manufacturer support. And also, interestingly enough, the need to work around limitations in the current IEEE 1394 kernel driver, which only started coming to the fore when we started really pushing that driver to get latencies down. And as a side issue, there's a new FireWire driver in the works, written by a guy at Red Hat called FireWire, and that's being sort of shaken down now in the kernels. I don't know how long it's going to take before that becomes a default driver that you can actually use. I know a couple of people or a couple of distros enabled it prematurely, and it's caused a lot of trouble. But it will eventually solve a lot of our problems. So in 2007, we rewrote the streaming code, improved stability, continued internal code development. We've developed a D-bus-based framework to help control the devices. These devices have a number of settings that you can control via the computer. Some have hardware control of that as well. A lot of them don't, so the only way of controlling devices is through the computer. And we're talking about things like gain structures and volume controls and modes for the different inputs and switching phantom power and other useful things like that. So we've got a D-bus-based framework to do that. Some of the devices like Sapphire, you can do that with it now. Others are still waiting. And it should be noted that in 2007, we had a number of manufacturers actually coming on board and saying that they supported what we did and gave us hardware to prove it, and also contacts with engineers and things. Mackie, Focusrite, Echo Audio are three that I could remember while the network was down this morning and I was writing this stuff. Unfortunately, there are still others that are refusing to help. RME is flat outrightly refusing to help with their Fireface 800. Motu's still telling me to get stuffed, which is disappointing, especially given that RME actually supported Linux quite substantially with their earlier Hammerfall-based cards. Their attitude with their FireWire devices is totally the opposite. It's really quite sad. Current status, things work with restrictions. I still say that those unreleased FreeBob snapshots, for me, with the Motu, are still more stable. There are some reasons for that. We think we pretty much understand them, and we're sort of trying to work those things out now. As I said, some devices behave better than others. We are planning to do a beta release soon, but we've got a few outstanding issues that we need to solve first. We've got to drop the CPU loading, which is currently far too high. On my development system, it's taking 15% of the CPU, which I think is absolutely ridiculous, given that standard sound cards are like closer to 0.5%, if that. Again, we know why. We're suffering a lot from float to int conversions, which aren't optimized yet, and we're working on that now. The other thing we've got to really nail is this issue of timing accuracy. Unfortunately, it doesn't, even running real-time kernel, sometimes things can not happen quick enough, and the Motu's timing is so sensitive that the current code can't keep lock and it dies. Again, we're working on that. I've got ideas about how to resolve that, and hopefully in a month or so I'll have time to actually do some tests and work it out. For the release, we'd also like to have mixer controls in place for more devices rather than just one or two that we've got at the moment. For some devices like the Motu, that's not a major issue because you can still control that from the front panel, but a lot of the devices, particularly the cheaper ones like the Firebox from Presonus, actually have no hardware control. You've got to use the software. And so to make these devices truly useful under Linux, we really need to fill out the details in those back ends to make sure that we can control them from the computer. And although it's not going to stop us releasing, we'd obviously like to support even more devices, but the problem with that is that a lot of the devices we can't get manufacturer data, so it's hard. And the other problem is that devices we're talking about are often costing $1,500 up to $3,000, and not everybody has access to those sorts of devices, and so it takes time to find people with the requisite coding skills that are able to help out with the project. We are picking up more as time goes on, but you know, obviously if people come forward with a new interface, then we're fairly open to wanting to support it. I'd really love to add support for the Fireface 800. I just can't afford it. I have access to one about one time a year for about a day, which doesn't lend itself to a huge speed on that little project. So the project website's up on the slide. There's no actual tarball to download yet because we're still basically in the pre-release thing. People can pull stuff out of Subversion if they need it at the moment, and there's instructions on the website about how to do that. But yeah, I think Peter wants to roll a release in a month or so, but I'm not quite sure how that's all going to fit together yet. Depends on how busy all of us really get between now and then. So that's the state of play with FireWire. Yep, very briefly. There's numerous ways of doing it. You can buy dedicated sniffer products, which can be helpful because they can deal more readily with the streaming data. These devices stream a lot of data. However, the way I ended up doing it was that I bought what's called a PCI Lynx card from Thailand. And these PCI Lynx cards are totally incompatible with every single FireWire card that is in laptops and stuff. It basically uses a totally different way of driving the chip. It's a totally different interface. Every FireWire device in a computer uses this thing called OHCI. Now, the reason why PCI Lynx cards are relatively hard to get is because there is no driver for Windows. They are not supported under Windows. And so, obviously, the market's small. That's why you've got to go overseas to get it. However, the beauty of the PCI Lynx card is that it actually allows you to sniff the type of traffic that's used to control the device. You cannot do that with an OHCI card. The hardware does not pass the packets through. You cannot get at them. And so I used this card. I think it cost me about $120, landed in Australia, connected that up into a second Linux box, and basically daisy-chained the thing through to a Windows box, and then did things on the Windows box, watched what happened on the bus, and then deduced the protocol based on what I was seeing there. So in a certain extent, it's like the French cafe technique that the Samba guys used to great effect as well. Oh, thousands. Yeah. The beauty of the hardware analyzer is that they can actually cope with the megabytes of data that flies past on a regular basis with these interfaces because of the audio. Obviously, the control packets are a small part of that data stream. And I took there's a piece of Linux software called Nosy, which is the software that you use with these PCI Lynx cards to do this sort of thing. And I ended up hacking Nosy quite significantly in order to basically reject the data I already knew about and reduce it to a flow that I could actually cope with and log and then analyze later on. I used a fairly heavily modified version of Nosy in the end to do basically what your FireWire bus capture devices do in hardware already.
But yeah, but it was a lot cheaper.
Other questions?
Okay, thanks.